On Talk Radio 98.5 and 1240 WRTA, it is WRTA Weekend. Doug Herendeen and the collector inspector, the guy that used to host the national show What You Got, antique and collectibles expert, if I could talk, Harry Rinker. Hey, Harry.
Hey, Happy New Year.
Yeah, it is. When do you stop saying Happy New Year? I mean, it's still a new year, right?
Well, it's the first time I've talked to you.
So that works.
Since the new year?
Yeah.
It always works.
So that works.
Then again, I'm the kind of guy that would like the New Year's to be happy the whole time, although I'm enough of a realist to know that that doesn't happen.
Yeah, it's true. Well, anyway, Harry Rinker is with us, and if you saw the notice on our Facebook page, you knew that we were going to be recording when we are, and you're hearing it now, and we want to talk about some stuff. We have one of our ardent fans, the Clarkster, who will be calling in a bit later. But
well, we'll talk about a few things before we get to that, because you did some antiquing here a few weeks ago.
Oh, I love doing that stuff. Yeah, it's in Duncansville. When we post the picture, you know exactly where it is if you go to these places. And I strongly urge you to go to these places, even if you're just window shopping. Who knows? You might buy a few windows. But it's something called Vaseline. Why was it called Vaseline glass?
What was the color of Vaseline? You know, the Vaseline was not always the grayish color. Historically, it was a very yellow color.
Yeah, I think it still is, but I haven't seen it for a while.
No, it's more of a light gray color, but apparently, historically, it was very, very colorful in terms of its color. What happened was that when you create glass, uranium was used as an ingredient. Some glass had turned red, but normally there was a green glass that had a light green glass that had uranium in it, and when it was put under a fluorescent light, it turned a bright yellower and so forth. And so it got the name Vaseline glass. Now, it's a formula that was used historically at the early part of the 20th century and then all the way through the 20th century into the 21st. So you just can't put a ultraviolet light on a piece of glass and it turns it fluoresces this yellow and say, oh, well, that's an old piece of Vaseline glass. But the problem is, as you hear me talk about all the time when we do this show, is that most of the people that collected Vaseline glass are dead because very few people collect it anymore. And the problem is that the old timers that have it for sale paid a lot of money for it. So you go to the antique mall and there's a whole case of it filled up and there's a fluorescent light. And there are prices that you couldn't buy a hamburger. Well, you might be able to buy multiple hamburgers for the price they're asking. And they're asking and asking and asking. Nobody's buying it. I mean, you go back to that mall today, you'll see the same glass there again. It's there long enough for the guy to understand that he can't sell it and then stop paying the rent.
Well, I don't know about that. It just depends on what people like. Most people that I've shown this to have no idea what it is. I did simply because I remember it as a kid, and I remember you explaining what it was.
Yeah,
is this radioactive in the sense that it's maybe not the best thing to have around your house?
No. You eat off of it and helps keep your teeth clean. Spread rumors. No,
yeah.
But you hit the nail on the head, Doug. My bet would be that if one person out of 100 that went in that mall looked at that glass and knew what it was, that's a high percentage. Who's going to buy anything they don't know what it is?
Well, if they like it, they would buy it, because here's the thing. I look at that, and that's an impressive display, I got to tell you. Am I tempted to buy it? Yeah. Do I need it? No. Can I afford it right now? I'd rather not.
And who would come to your house, see a cabinet with ultraviolet lights in it and a bunch of that and say, that's a neat display. Not anybody I know.
But, you know, I buy things that I like. I don't buy them to show them off. I mean, some people do. I have a lot of radios. Not everybody has seen them.
buy things that you like, but look at the price first.
Yeah. Oh, I think so. I mean, look, there are some radios that I have.
Look, if you bought every radio you like, buddy, you'd be living in a warehouse.
Yeah, and I would also be living in the poorhouse. And I said, you know, when I used to live in an apartment, the good thing was I ran out of space before I ran out of money, or otherwise I'd be broke. That's pretty much true. The cheapest radio I ever bought at an auction was $4. And I've seen that same radio for sale for ridiculous prices elsewhere. I don't know if anybody's getting them, but, you know, that's fine if you want to spend it.
But I think the reality is, and we both know this, markets are not cyclical. You know, the old theory was, well, something would go up in price and then people would stop buying it, but then the economy would catch up to that number, and then what seemed expensive would seem cheap. But today, if people don't remember it, they're not going to buy it. If they don't have a connection with it, they're not going to buy it. Totally unrelated subject here. I was out to lunch the other day with a friend of mine who is about, I'm 84, he's 93. And we were talking about hitchhiking as kids. Okay, I hitchhiked. He went to school in Boston and lived over in Hamilton, Ontario. He hitchhiked back and forth on that thing. And then, so we talked about that. But the thing about it was, and I said, yeah, I used to hitchhike a lot, and I picked up hitchhikers. And then he said, have you ever seen a hitchhiker recently?
No.
And I said to myself, no. I really haven't. Not. I can't remember the last time I saw a hitchhiker. And it's like, you know, all of a sudden it doesn't revive itself. And besides that, who's going to hitchhike in the snowstorms?
Well, yeah, especially around here. But I'll give you an example of something where I didn't know what it was when I first saw it, but I knew of them. And it's a mystery. You remember mystery clocks?
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, it looks like it's floating on a piece of glass, although you don't really see the glass if it's clean enough. And you wonder, well, gee, how is that running? And it's a unique thing, and it's got a motor, and it moves the glass, and it moves the hands. I didn't have one when I was a kid, but I certainly did get one later in life. The motors don't last forever, the sad fact about that is. But they're kind of unique. So I bought something that was older than I am because I liked it.
Yeah, well, you know, the interesting thing about that is I used to buy what I call neat things. I'd see something I didn't recognize, but I said, that's neat.
Yeah.
And I bought a lot of just neat stuff, and it was neat to me. I mean, I had a whole collection of neat things at one point there. I don't know what happened to them, but they went by the way of all things. I just thought they were weird. I mean, there was a close connection between neat and weirdness to me.
Yeah, I think so.
The weirder the object, the neater it was.
There are people that still do shows on YouTube saying, hey, guess what this is? And people sit there, oh, I have no idea. And it's something that was used commonly, say, 150 years ago, where they look at us in the future you uncultured swine, how can you not know what that is? I use that every day.
Listen, I have to tell you, did I ever tell you about the time I was in an antique mall and a mother and a daughter came in, and a daughter picks up one of the old hand egg beaters? You know the ones I'm talking about, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And she says to her mother, what's this? And the mother says, I have the vaguest idea. They think all scrambled eggs came in cardboard containers, and you just pour them in a pan.
Man, that's sad. But you know,
well, same. Well, somebody brought in a flour grater to one of my appraisal clinics. You know,
yeah, sifter.
Just, you know, the kind you hold in one hand and you turn the thing and grate the flour, because we used to grate the flour 2-3 times before we made the pie crust and stuff.
Yeah, my mother used
one.
She
said to me, she said, what's this? I said, what do you mean, what's that? She said, well, I don't know what this is. I found it in my grandma's kitchen. Oh, okay. Heavens to Betsy. It was a flour shifter.
Believe it or not, in the last week, I forget where I was, I saw brand new ones. They're not antiques. They are brand new sifters.
Oh, no. They're still around.
I thought, well, if I needed it, this would be great. Now I know where to buy one, if I can remember where it was that I saw it. But it was actually brand new, manufactured, and it worked fine. Picked it up, played with it for a bit, put it down because I didn't need it. And it's certainly not an antique, but it was just kind of interesting that, oh, wow, they're making these again. Maybe everything old is new again.
No, they never stop making them. There are certain kitchen gadgets that are always there.
Yeah.
There may be different variations in the handle or the mechanism. I mean, you know, the one my mother had, you had to turn a little crank, but then they got this handle that you could squeeze back and forth, and that would swing the thing over.
Right, that's what this
over
one
the
was.
Screen and
and
do it. But no, it's, you know, someday they're going to look at me and say, "Who's that?" You know,
yeah.
What can I say?
Well, you know, I have to wonder. There's a whole generation that probably thinks a rolling pin was never used for making dough for pies or anything else, but it's just used for hitting people in comics of years ago.
That is assuming that they can they read comics or see the old cartoons from years ago. Otherwise, they have no idea what it's for.
Do you remember a comic, and I didn't know it until just about a year ago, called The Opinions or the Rants of Everett True?
The what?
It's Everett True. It's a character who was just, he was mad about every, he usually ended up hitting somebody unless his wife socked him in the mouth for saying something stupid.
And this was a comic book?
This was a daily comic that was in newspapers apparently
in
all
the
over
paper,
the country.
In the paper?
Yeah, in the 1920s. And
okay,
it's gotten new life on the internet.
That's a little too early. No, that's a little too early for me, even for me.
Yeah, but the funny thing is there's Facebook groups dedicated to this comic, and it's from 100 years ago.
What's it called?
The Rants or the Outbursts of Everett True. Look it up on Facebook. You'll find several groups that are just dedicated to this.
Doing that while we talk.
Yeah, and I think they're even printing new copies of the book. It's probably in public domain by now because there were a collection of it. Yeah,
the Outburst of Everett's True.
Everett
Read
True.
Online.
Yeah, yeah. It's amazing to me. Did I know that as a kid? No, I never heard of it until 2 years ago, and I started reading them on Facebook.
Well, you know, I was an avid comic reader, both of comic newspaper comics and comic books as a kid.
Yeah.
Because my mother worked at the drugstore. Her brother owned a drugstore, and she was in charge of the newsstand and the comic books and the magazines that came in. So when they came in, my mother would bring home 50 to 60 new comics, and then I'd have to read them in a day and send them back.
No. Recycling. If you haven't seen it, it's new to you.
But it was great mental training because there I am keeping track of about 50 different stories and things and from one edition to the next. And some of them, that was the age of the cowboy comics and others. And, you know, the stories would carry over and the characters and so forth.
Right.
But it was great fun. It was great fun. I attributed part of my photographic memory back in those eras to that practice of going through 50 comics in a day.
WRTA Weekend, Doug Herendeen. We have Harry Rinker as in Antiques and Collectibles, What You Got. And we have the Clarkster, one of our, in fact, he found WRTA by trying to find Harry's show, and he liked the local shows we did, and he stuck with us on this. Clarkster, you sent a whole bunch of stuff. Harry, what's the first thing you want to talk about?
What I need to know is, is this all the girl comics your wife saved, or does she have a whole stash of them?
No, she has more. She's probably got 2 to 3 dozen of them.
Yeah.
Different Jughead and stuff like that. Yeah.
Well, yeah, these were the preteen comics for young ladies.
Mm-hmm.
You got one here, one, the comic Little Dot at Kathy, which is probably the Teenage Tornado. Archie's Madhouse. Now, that's the big one because Archie and Jughead and Veronica and so forth, they're probably the most memorable of the teenage comics of that era. When you deal with a comic, and they were from the 10-cent era, so that's the golden age of comics prior to 1960. We won't date your wife by the fact that she has these.
I hope you won't date her.
I knew that was coming.
No matter how you want to spell that, buddy, don't sweat it.
Yeah.
But what happens is that comics such as these do not have a deep following, and condition is everything. But what also is important is what number are they? Now, it was kind of interesting because normally when you look at a comic page, and I'm looking at the cover now for Archie's Madhouse, there is a picture of Archie falling to pieces, and Jughead is talking to gal there, and it says, poor Archie, every time he has to take a math exam, he goes all to pieces. Of course, these characters were in high school at the time. But it's an October issue, but it doesn't say which one.
No.
And in these early comics, condition is critical, but it's also much more important whether you have volume one, number one, the very first issue or second or third issue of the comics, because those are the scarce ones. Other than that, they were bought in huge quantities. So, you know, I didn't bother to look them all up. But, you know, it's again, the Archie comics spun off numerous sub-comics. And so
right. The
two Archie comics she has, the one is from the Archie Madhouse series, the other one is from the Archie Laugh series. So my guess is, looking at them, they're in the $2 to $4 range, maybe a little bit more. But they do seem to be at least in somewhat reasonably good condition. There's a little fraying on the sides. Now, the other ones I thought were at least more interesting to me. Little Dot was a young girl one, and I would think, again, the number of people interested in that is minimal. And then there's Little Lolita, who turns out to be a bit on the hefty side. And I would think that would be seen today as a very politically incorrect comic for that.
But
then again, there are people that collect politically incorrect stuff. So my guess is that she might bring a little bit more. But the one that I really liked was Kathy the Teenage Tornado. My guess is that doesn't last very long, that series. And so that would be in there, and she is shopping for a swimsuit, and I love the cut line on the cover. "Don't you have any briefer swimwear suit than these, Mr. Smith?" And he says, "Why don't you try our handkerchief department, Kathy?" and so Kathy was, no wonder she was known as a teenage tornado. But they're fun to have, and they're the kind of thing that what somebody would do with them, I'm very serious about this, is they get their hands on them. If they're in reasonably good condition, they stick them in a frame, a cheap $2, $5 frame from a store, and charge $35 for them as a wall hanger and not as a comic book.
The only thing I would suggest, if you're going to frame them, something that I was taught about, if you have something that has transferable ink, which I would imagine all these are, or if you have an autographed picture, get one with the matted deal. Yeah, because otherwise, if it's against the glass, you're going to ruin the actual item.
Oh, you sure? I mean, by the way, I just looked at the Archie Laugh comic series, and it's number 115 in the series. So, you know, you're not talking about one of the early ones.
Yeah.
Right. I'd have to look through the rest of them.
With the exception of Little Lota, and if you stop to think about it, since she was heavy, Lota carries a little bit of subtitle there. All the young ladies in those comics were all very thin-waisted, very 50-ish.
Well, especially since the artists were men, so what do you expect?
Well, I'll tell you one thing. The comic images pushed the standards of the times.
Oh, I'm sure. Yeah, well, it was an idealized version of men and women, although the guy was usually, like Archie was the lovable schlub, and especially Jughead was. So their comic relief, whereas the women were treated differently, although not deferentially.
Yeah, and I was just trying to think now. It was Archie and Jughead, and Veronica was the
Veronica and Betty.
Who was
Betty,
yes. Good old Betty, yes.
Yeah.
Poor Betty.
Yeah.
Now, she did not look like Veronica, I will say
The eternal question, Betty or Veronica, Marianne or the other one?
Yeah, there you go.
Gilligan's Island, that tells you my answer. So we're just talking a couple of bucks on that. The interesting thing to me is, and I was going to ask about this a little later in the show, it shows you how different generations will look at things. These comics, you're saying, a couple of bucks. A first edition of one of the Harry Potter novels recently sold for $50,000. First edition.
Oh, bullfet. You know what? You read too much damn crap on the internet.
But somebody paid for it. Some idiot paid $50,000 for it.
All right, now you sent me this article. You opened the door for this one, buddy. You sent me this article about, you know, you've got $50,000 or more in your closet. Go raid your closet.
Yeah, well, I'm not buying that.
Okay, now yes, you're done. First of all, you're not going to buy it. Second of all, okay, the collectibles market in the United States reached $62 billion in 2024 and showed no slowing down. I don't know where Grandview Research came up with that number, but they must have had a big dartboard there where they threw darts at it.
That's right.
Okay, we'll get to Clark's other stuff. Now, the thing about it, you got to read the subtitle, right?
Yeah.
First of all, this is the first edition of Harry Potter published in the British Empire, in Britain.
Yes.
Not in the United States.
Right.
And it's signed by the author.
Okay.
So now, first of all, this edition never made it to the U.S., okay? Because it sold for nine and a quarter, whatever that is, shillings or whatever.
Yeah.
Okay, so the chances of anybody finding a copy of that in their American closet is somewhere between slim and impossible, okay?
Yeah.
The second thing is that it has to be another thing. It has to be, in order to bring that kind of money, it has to be a first edition, first printing.
Yeah.
If it's a second or third or fourth printing, the value goes down.
Yeah, what's the point?
If it's signed by the author, the value goes down. And so, you know, how many of these things survive? My guess is there's probably a couple of dozen or more, even maybe 100 in the marketplace. But they're not in the marketplace in America. They're not in America closets.
Yeah.
It's all sensationalism. That the Internet is full with sensational crap.
Well, that's the most accurate statement I've heard in a long time.
Yes. They're not surprising it comes from my mouth either.
Yeah. Well, let's get back to some of the stuff from Clarkster. Since we just got done with Christmas, I want to talk about the shiny, bright ornaments there.
Let's talk about shiny, bright ornaments.
I think we all had those.
You did if you grew up in the late 40s and 50s, because prior to World War II, all the glass ornaments came from Germany. They came from an area around a town called Luschau. I've been there, and they still make the glass ornaments there, and I visited many of the shops and the other things that do that. But then when we had a little dispute with the Germans in 1941 and thereabouts, and the dry gun, a few American companies came forward and made glass Christmas tree ornaments, and the government let them because they didn't want the people not to be able to decorate their trees, and they didn't want them decorating their trees with old German ornaments.
Mm-hmm.
So one of the most famous companies, of course, was called Shiny Bright. But there was also a box of the North American Glass Corporation ornaments, the American-made tree ornaments. This was the big deal. Of course, in the 40s, they were American-made. Now, here's the problem. Okay, the boxes are great, and I think that's where the value is, actually, because when you put your ornaments on a Christmas tree, and trust me, I did as a kid in the late 40s and early 50s, you took the ornaments father saved the boxes. My dad was a big box saver, so we could repack everything again, but we just fill a tree up. We never took note of what ornaments came out of what box. So, you know, I look at the one box he has of American-made ornaments, and I'm thinking to myself, I wonder how many of the ornaments in that box were there when the box was sold. But it is a box from the 1940s or early 1950s, and it is a box of ornaments from that time period, so it gets away with that. Actually, about 10 years ago, there was a big, huge interest in these shiny, bright ornaments and boxes. And the first one's a box of six, and the other one is, I think it may be just six, but a box of six would bring about 12 to 15 bucks, and a box of a dozen might bring 25 to 30 bucks. Mm-hmm. Actually, I think the boxes alone are worth add $5 to whatever price you're going to charge a piece for the ornaments. Because the boxes are neat. They're great display pieces. And even though the shiny bright box with all the cute little ornaments on the cover and so forth, I like the American-made box with the open things where you can look and see the ornaments. And I really like the modern graphics of the American-made North American Glass Company box. So I think they're kind of neat. And does Clarkster put these on his tree every year?
Yes. Yes, we do.
Yeah, you should. Well, you know, this is, I used, back when I had the school, I used to set up a minimum of 5 Christmas trees a year, and then I had my July 5th rule. Do you know what that was? If the Christmas trees were still up by July 5th, they stayed up for the rest of the year.
That's great.
the 4th of July tree.
Yeah.
No, I don't know if you've noticed it or not, but today the big thing is Halloween ornaments on Christmas trees. So they
right.
now assume that you're going to buy your Christmas tree by Halloween.
Or Easter ornaments on a tree.
Well, you can. Yes, that's right. I mean, they're doing anything to sell this stuff. It was a fun time. Now we're down here in Florida, but all my trees are up in Michigan. I used to have a big artificial tree. I had a live tree. I had two aluminum trees, and I had an old feather tree. The earliest artificial trees were made out of goose feathers wrapped. Stained green and wrapped around a wire to look like fur.
I did not know that.
I discovered my family one because my aunts, when they were cleaning out my grandfather's house, were trashing stuff in the garbage can. I pulled up the garbage can lid. You know me. I was.
Oh, of course.
And there was the base of my grandfather's feather Christmas tree. I saved it.
Cool.
I won't tell you what other thing I saved from my grandfather's trash can, but it was white and had a white hood.
Well, moving right along, just as far as the ornaments, a friend of mine, guy I used to work with, his sister is huge into shiny, bright ornaments, and I sent pictures I saw of some, they were almost as nice as these, but not quite. And they were asking something like $45 for the one box and $100 for the other. And I got a text back, nah, she already has those particular ornaments.
No, well, that, you know, but there again, you raise another interesting point in my business. What is something worth to a person when somebody has what they want of one, if that makes any sense?
Yeah, I mean, if you already have it, you're not going to pay to have a duplicate unless it's really important to you.
I bought a Hopalong Cassidy hat for $225, kid's hat, for my collection. And a guy wrote me and said, I have another one. I'll sell it to you for $200. I said, no, you'll sell it to me for $45 because that's what the second one's worth to me.
Yeah. Well, that makes some sense.
Well, before we leave this topic, I got to interject something. We were up along Route 29 along the Delaware early in December.
Yep.
And we went into a place called Antique Haven in Kitnersville.
Yeah.
Okay, and they had a shiny bright box that had the box already had the price embedded in it, the original price. It was either $2.95 or $3.95. It was a box of 10 or 12, and they were trying to sell it for $28.
Yeah.
You know, my friend's sister probably would have bought it if she didn't already have it for that price. Yeah, I think she would have.
Yeah. Now, it looked
but
like
then
they
again,
were
what,
shiny,
what right? is any ornament worth when you have a tree that's so full you can't put anything else on it?
Well, that's
you trade
them out different years, you put different ones on.
Yeah, we usually have two trees, but one's a real small tree and the other is the bigger tree. But we used to have two bigger trees, one in the window and one in the family room. And so there were plenty of space to use a lot of these Christmas balls, you know. But my wife is great at the decoration. I'm just in construction, but she's in the decoration side.
Yeah, that's pretty much the way it is here.
I assume it's time to take a break, but when
yes,
we come back, I want to talk about the watch.
It's WRTA Weekend. Doug Herendeen, Harry Rinker is in What You Got, talking antiques and collectibles. Clarkster, regular caller, has sent some stuff in. There's a pocket watch here. What's this about, Clarkster?
Well, it's the one from the New York City Fire Department. My wife's paternal grandfather was a fireman up in New York, and he retired sometime probably in the late 50s, I believe.
Yeah, I would think that's about right, Clarkster, absolutely.
Yeah, and
it's an open-face Elgin watch, stem-wound, right?
Right.
Yep.
And it's really interesting. On the back, it's got the fire department emblem, and there is a 20, which is probably means he got it for 20 years of service.
You got
the department.
Yeah.
Oh, I thought it was the station number.
No.
What?
I thought it might have been the station number, but it's 20 years of service.
No. I'm almost certain, Clark said that it's a 20-year
Okay.
Watch.
Yes.
For certain, because they could retire at 20 years. That was the standard retirement age for firemen. But now, a couple of questions. Does it work?
That's a no.
It doesn't sound like yes.
No, I got to go back and revisit it, but I would tend to defer. It probably doesn't, but, you know.
Well, now wait a minute. First of all, if it doesn't work, then its value is somewhat negligible. But the other thing is, try winding the stem a little bit, and then if it doesn't work, hit it on the table a couple of times to get the second hand moving. Because oftentimes the lubricant just comes up and the watch won't work.
I'm thinking tap it would be far a better thing to describe
right.
it as.
No, really bang it. It won't hurt it.
Sure.
The
other thing is, did you ever take the back off?
No, I never. Never wanted to do that. No.
Well, the thing about it is, the question is it gold plated or is it gold? Now, if it was gold plated, then it's a whole different world. And I suspect the 20 has. I couldn't see if it has little jewels in it or it's just.
Yes.
It's just.
Yes. Yes.
It has little jewels in it, right?
Yeah.
Yes.
Well, they could be diamond chips, but if
yes,
and so you got three factors here in terms of value. If it doesn't work, that's one value. If it works and has a gold plated back with a few diamond chips in there or maybe fake diamonds, that's another value. Or if it has a gold back and little diamond chips, that's a third value. Now, if it's not working, then I would tell you it's what we would call a junker normally. But because it's fire related,
right?
The fire collectors would buy it anyway, even if it doesn't work.
Sure.
Especially because it says New York on it. It's FD New York on it. So you're absolutely right. It's the fire department of New York City. Furthermore, you probably have a picture of this guy or your wife does, and you could put it with a watch which says, okay, this is who he is. And if he's in his fireman's uniform, that's even better.
And we do have something
even
like that.
Even not working with a picture of the guy and knowing who it was, it's a $25 to $50 watch if it's not gold plated to a fire collector. But then if it's up and working, okay, with that in the back, it goes from about a $35 to $45 watch up to about a $75 to $100 watch. And then if it should happen to be 14 or carat gold, my Lord, then you're talking hundreds of dollars because the sheer melt value of gold these days is huge.
Yep.
So you got to get it out, man, and see if it works.
Well, the other thing I wanted to ask, when you took those pictures, were you wearing something blue that reflected off it, or is that like, it looks to me like some of that's wearing off and turning blue like mood rings used to when I was a kid.
No,
so
that's the...
That was reflection.
Non-expertise of the picture taker here.
Okay. As long as it's not the actual metal, then that's
no,
much
it's
better.
No, it's not. No, it's fine.
Okay. Well, let's see here. Oh, I'll deal with one other short one, and then when we come back, I'll deal with you had these two wooden salt and pepper shakers made by the Vermont Wood Specialties?
Yes.
Come on, Clarkster. Do you have a fireplace?
You need a little kindling to start that's fire? Mean.
No, it isn't mean. Come on, man. He has the receipt. They only paid $2 and some odd cents for each one of them. And then there's a business card with a zip code, which means they were made after 1896. And they were meant to look like they were made 150 years earlier.
When it was 2002.
Yeah. So it's faux antique.
It's 25 years. Another year it'll be.
I'll tell you what, and my guess is that your wife doesn't use them as salt and pepper shakers either.
We actually bought three pair, went beyond the Harry edict of buying two of everything. So how do you make out on those toys? But we gave one set away to a collector.
Well, that's what, well, you know what, when all else fails with something like this, you got it right. They're called wedding gifts. You make up the story. These belong to your grandmother, and she truly cherished them. And they were left to us, and we just been waiting for the right person to leave them to. And we couldn't think of anybody else better than you.
Actually, they were kind of like uh, the not a gag gift, but a Pollyanna type thing where you were supposed to spend under $5 or something way back when. We probably put the business card in there so they knew it was somewhat, you know, the U.S. made.
Well, the other thing you could do, Carter, is you set them out in the snow for a couple of days, and then dry them out real quick, and then you can pass them off as antique.
Yeah, yeah. Well, we only have another year to go or so, and it will hit 25.
In cars, that's classic, not antique.
Well, the best offer over $2.95 then.
Well, think about it, plus inflation.
No. The best offer over 25 cents.
That's yard sale material.
Yes, you bet.
We have a little time in this segment, and if you want to go along, we'll just do a shorter one next. I wanted to ask about this stamp. An envelope here from the Bicentennial Commemorative Medal. It's WRTA Weekend. Doug Herendeen, Harry Rinker as in Antiques and Collectibles and What You Got used to be the Collector Inspector in HGTV when they had much more interesting shows than some of the ones they have now that they show over and over. And we have the Clarkster, one of our regular callers to the show, and something he said. And you'll see all this stuff on the podcast of this program. We'll put it on the podcast page. The official First Continental Congress Bicentennial Commemorative Medal. It's an envelope. It's stamped in 1974, before the Bicentennial, actually. September 5th, 1974, in Philadelphia. First day of issue on the stamp as well. Clarkster, any story behind this you want to give us before Harry chimes in?
No, just that my father-in-law was a stamp collector and coin collector, and that's...
Yeah, well, in this case, he didn't do that badly because of what he bought. At least he didn't buy the pewter ones. Now, I'm confused, Clarkster. In the picture of the envelope you sent, is that a little magnifying glass that's sitting there?
You mean that little piece of paper there?
No.
The round thing. That's the way it was printed.
No, that's a coin. That's like a silver coin, I believe.
That's a silver dollar coin. I got it.
Yep.
First of all, it's very interesting about the Bicentennial because by 1976, people were so sick of the Bicentennial that we were Bicentennial out before it happened.
Your Bicentennial
it's
moment?
It's a little bit better now with the Scepter Semicentennial, but even so. But I'm going to get a quick plug in here before we go to the medal set because of the fact that you mentioned the stamps. The Postal Service is now starting to issue the stamps commemorating the 250th anniversary of America, and the new battleground stamps came out, the pane of four battleground stamps. Mm. And that was one of the last set of stamps I approved when I was on the Stamp Commission. But I know many of the others that are coming out down the line, and I'm looking forward to them, so encourage people to go out and buy them. Anyway, what happened is, first of all, it says United States Constitution coins. Now, what happens is that these are not coins that were struck by the American government. You know, there was some act of Congress, but these were designed to be sold for their bullion value. Now, the good news was that the bullion value of silver and gold back at that time was low, was high, but not as high as it is now. So the value of the box set is largely melt value plus maybe a couple of bucks. But most people would buy the set for the melt value of the gold or the silver, and then once they did that, they'll just sell them and melt them because they have no collecting value beyond that.
Wow.
Okay. Well, hey, yeah, but it's not like buying the pewter ones where you pay $35 to $50 a coin. They weren't worth crap because pewter is lead and tin. So, I mean, and they're encapsulated, so nobody handled them.
Right.
And, you know, and they put that bicentennial stamp thing. And that when I first looked at it, I thought maybe that was a first day of issue cover. And, you know, first day of issue covers were hugely collectible, not so much in the 70s, but back in the 50s and 60s with all those cachets that they had. And today you can buy them on the market for anywhere from 50 cents to a couple bucks a piece, except for one or two exceptions. Or, well, maybe a dozen exceptions, but most of them, their market's so flooded with them that nobody wants them. But the thing about it is that the gold coins dated 1987. Clarkster, that my guess is that gold coin is several hundred dollars or more at this point in the game. Or certainly much more than $5. I mean, an ounce of gold is what? An ounce of gold is now,
it's almost getting up to $5,000. It's $4,900 and some odd dollars.
This is, you have to be careful about this, though. Okay, so it's $5,000 bucks more or less. Let's use that. And this, right. The weight of this is 2.687 troy ounces, so that's a quarter of an ounce. And so if an ounce is worth, an ounce of gold is worth 4,000, the coin's worth at least 1,000 melt in today's market or more.
Right.
Okay. Now, silver is what? Silver is up around 16 or 18 the last time I looked.
It hit 100 today.
100 what?
$100 per ounce.
For an ounce of silver?
Yes.
Well, you're kidding me.
No. That's where it is today.
Then you got $75 to $85 worth of melt silver.
What do you know? All those radio talk show hosts on the network there are sitting there saying, hey, buy gold and silver. They weren't just blowing smoke.
Yeah, but you should have bought gold and silver back in 1987, not now.
Yeah, well.
The official number is 101.575 as we speak.
Man, I'll tell you one thing, man. I got a bunch of people out of the old silver coinage at what, $35 or $45 an ounce? To the dollar when the Hunts were trying to corner the silver market. Man, if they'd held on to it now, they'd be even richer yet.
Yep.
But anyway, let's go back to the other one, which is the bicentennial one. There is a troy ounce of silver. But this is one full troy ounce. So,
right.
You know, is that bar 99.9 firm? One ounce of troy silver.
Yeah.
Well,
yeah.
Heck, if an ounce of troy silver is $1,000 today, that little silver ingot's a cute little bugger.
It says 999 fine.
Yeah, but
1 ounce troy silver.
Almost,
yep.
That's almost 100% silver.
I guess.
You just said a troy ounce of silver today is $100.
Yes.
Right.
Yep.
Well, there's another $100. Man, I wouldn't be. You better get him to take this stuff off the air before someone knocks on your door and tries to rob you. But the fun thing in that one is a dollar bill.
Yeah, the silver certificate.
A $1 bill.
Yes.
Well, what happened, of course, is, now, again, how old do you have to be to remember this stuff? And the answer is pretty darn old. But American currency used to be supported by the silver and gold at Fort Knox. That ended, I forget when, sometime, I think in the 60s, and paper became backed by other things. So, but here, this is the thing. I remember when the silver certificates went out, my mother ran down the bank and got $100 worth of silver certificates and said, here, save these. They'll be worth money someday. Yes, $1. Because they'll always be worth $1.
Yeah.
So many people did that my guess is that even if one is pure, almost mint, you'd be lucky to get $2 to $5 for it.
Yeah.
You did much better with the silver ingot.
Right, right. I don't know how we got this. I mean, it's probably from one of our parents, but
but the point was that you kept it long enough. That's the key, man. Not everything works that way, but some things work that way.
Yeah, well,
the other thing I wanted to talk to you about real quick was that you had some old copies of Radio News, you know, the magazines for guys in radio.
Oh, I got a lot of copies of that. Doug, you know about that.
Yes.
Well, I wanted to tell you one of my recent stories. one of the ones that you sent shows a guy on a roof setting up a rotary beam. Well, remember when you first TVs, they used to have roof antennas with rotor rooters on them?
Yeah.
Yes.
So they could turn the antenna to get better signal from Philly or New York or wherever it was?
You got that right.
Well, I was doing some SAR genealogy work, which is what you know that I do almost all my spare time now. And a father and his son were up there trying to rig up one of these things on their roof when it fell over and hit a power line and electrocuted both of them. And they So, you know, I could, because I remember when my dad put his up on the roof, and I'm thinking, holy crap, lucky for him. He made it down the ladder.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But
well,
anyway.
My father was a Philco guy, was a Philco
right,
technician.
He was. And, yes, we did a lot of Philco memorabilia in the past years.
Right.
But the, right. But the thing about it, if you can get 25 cents to 50 cents a piece for them, most people would buy them for the image on the cover, and that's about it.
Well, for what we have, that's probably $50 worth in those magazines.
Well, you know what? Well, now look, here's the guy. You take him to a radio meet. You know, to talk to our good buddy Doug here and find out where the local radio meet is in your area and throw him in the back of your car and take him and then walk around with them in a wagon and see who drools the most and sell them to them.
Clarkson,
the little wagon, the little red wagon I never kept.
Yeah, that would also be worth something. No, the closest one to you, Clarkster, and to me probably is Renninger's.
Yes, right. Well, which, what, Kutztown or Renninger's?
Do they do radio meets in Renninger's?
Yeah, once a year.
Oh, okay.
When they end the meet, they have a bunch of the cabinets that didn't sell, and they have a bonfire and get rid of them that way. And
yes,
the first time I ever saw that, I had a heart attack, and they're like, no, you don't understand. These are ones that cannot possibly be rebuilt, or they don't have their guts in them. Or it's like, yeah, well, still, you can make something out of them.
Yeah,
yeah, but I got news for you, though. The most interesting thing I ever saw from that point of view was I was at a farm and garden show in Iowa. Was it Illinois. And they have Cornhusker demolition derbies.
Mm.
And I watched Cornhuskers being demolished by running into each other. And it was, I thought, boy, what an interesting use of old Cornhuskers. You know, the big Cornhusking machines. But they had demolition derbies with them. And they were serious, man. They banged each other. Man, that was interesting. Enough said.
If there were people who were giving me a hard time on the radio some years ago, I used to tell them that they should buy track seats to the demolition derby. But that's another story. Most of them never got it.
Yeah. Well, my dad had a 36 Ford, and in 1952 he traded it in for a he traded it in for a 52 Ford Fairlane, and then a couple of years later, he gets wind of the fact that it was in a demolition derby up in Nazareth, PA, at the old Nazareth dirt track. And my father went up and watched his car being demolished. I to this day, I think my father had a really sick sense of humor.
Either that, or he was sick of that car.
I'm not too far behind.
No, no. You. Oh, no. That 36 Ford, I mean, he had it in the 50s. I was a young man in my teens while he had that car. It had a running board. It had a rumble seat in the back. It was one of the funnest cars to ride around in my life, man. Man, didn't you ever used to hop one of those cars, get in the running board, hang out there and drive down the road? Man, that was a heck of a drive.
No, the only cars I've seen like that are at car shows.
Oh, well, no, man. I was 52. I was 11 when my dad got the four-lane.
Mine was a 38 Buick with an egg crate in the back for a seat, and it was replaced. That was replaced by a 56 Chevy Bel Air.
Oh, should have been 1 year later, man.
Well, the 57, yeah.
Yeah.
Here's something. If you're going to talk about something along those lines, try to explain to somebody what a rumble seat was. Good luck.
That's true, man. People would say, do you have a rumble seat? Where did you put the suitcases? You know, what can you say?
Yeah. Well, any final thoughts, Clarkster?
No, I'll let you know the next time I'm calling in so Harry can chime in then, too. All right,
Parker,
great.
If I thought this was the last up in your attic or basement or sheds or closets, I'd say farewell and say it's been a great ride. But my guess is if they do another show, you'll find another 10 objects at least.
I was going to invite you to do a reclaim inspector collector by walking up the driveway here, you know, or something.
You know, it was a fun show. It was a fun show, but it was 20 years ago.
Yes.
It's been 20 years.
At least, yeah.
It'll be 20 years this last year when the last episode aired. But it's still on YouTube. Some of them are still on YouTube.
Yeah, so they are.
What the heck?
I think when we first started talking to you on the local WRTA show, that show was still on. So that would be about 20 years. You're right.
Wow, time flies.
Yeah.
Doesn't it? When you're collecting stuff.
It does indeed. Great talking with you. Say hi to us, all my good friends in the WRTA audience. It's been well over 20 years because I was back on with you in the 1980s.
Yeah.
With your predecessor.
Yeah, with Charlie Weston, probably.
It was one of my first shows that called me in to promote my book when we were doing call-ins.
And I'm sure you got the calls then, too. Clarkster, we'll say so long here. Harry, do you have a few more minutes?
Yeah, I do.
Okay, Clarkster, we'll say so long and listen for the show, and we'll do a longer podcast, okay?
Gotcha.
Take care. Bye now. The thing I wanted to ask you about, Harry, what we started talking about earlier, people paying ridiculous amounts of money for the first edition of a Harry Potter book. Yes, it had very various conditions and things like that, but I'm wondering if there is a new generation of collectors, but we just don't recognize them because it's things we wouldn't bother to collect. That thing, you think that's worth something? Yeah, like Nintendo game cartridges. There are people paying ridiculous amounts of money. A 4-gig Apple phone, Apple One phone, iPhone sold last year for $190,372. That's insane to me, but somebody wanted to pay it.
Yeah, but I remember when I owned one of the first pocket calculators.
Yeah.
The one that sold for $99. All it did was add, subtract, and divide it, and I had the original box.
The Bowman Brain.
The thing about it is, it's not what they bring today, it's what they bring 50 years from now.
Yeah.
How many of these things stand the test of time? Now, you know, you still have people buying Mickey Mantle baseball cards and early Batman, Superman comic books, and now they're in the millions of dollars. And you know, and it's been going on now for a good 50-plus years and going up. But there is a time when everything reaches a point where it's not going to be worth that ever again. And, you know, I've always been a long-term player because I've watched the antiques and collectible business for so many years. And I've watched things that were worth tons of money at one point today that are totally, totally worthless.
Yeah.
And it's all part of, you know, memory and whatever. When you take a 10-cent comic, encapsulate it so you can't read it, and then use it like a piece of art to speculate its value, there's going to be a day when somebody with a good head on their shoulders, and or a whole bunch of people with a good head on their shoulders, where that comic book is going to come up for auction, and somebody says, who in their right mind would pay that kind of price for this? We won't bid on it.
The tulip bulb idea. They used to collect tulip bulbs in Holland, and eventually the prices were bid up to astronomical rates, and people, one day somebody said, it's a tulip bulb. Why are we paying this? And the market collapsed.
Right. Well, I forget what it was, but there was a card auction or something where Christie's got involved in it. Or maybe it was autographed baseballs or something along those lines. And Christie's had this big auction, and the stuff sold for way under estimates. The stuff that sold, most of it didn't sold. And the headlines in the newspaper were, the mighty Christie's has struck out. Okay?
Yeah.
Well, look, we don't have to talk about that. Let's talk about radios.
Yeah.
Look at the market. Look. Remember the craze for transistor radios?
Well.
And some of them got to be very expensive.
And they still are if you go on eBay. I mean, some of them are selling for a lot of money.
But just because somebody on eBay is asking it doesn't mean they sell for that.
No, but if you look at the sold auctions, some of them are going to me at very inflated prices. But then again, I remember a pocket radio as a kid. I still have my first pocket radio. It was a Real Tone radio. But there are other people that are selling the same exact model, and they're asking a lot of money. And some of them are actually getting it. To me, selling something for like $50, that's a lot. There are some of the original transistor radios going for like $900, and some fools are paying it.
Well, because they read some of these radio price guides with these ridiculous prices in them and say, oh, that must be what it's worth.
When I went to the radio conventions maybe 30 years ago, upstate New York, there were people there that were probably my age now or older than me. And I would look at this stuff that was going on, and I liked the older stuff. The newer stuff did not really interest me. And I said, you know what's going to happen. Someday you're going to come to this convention and there are going to be people selling Apple IIc computers. They're going to be selling transistor radios. And these guys were looking at me, heretic, how dare you say that? Burn them at the stake. It's like, I said, it's going to happen. I won't buy them. You won't buy them. You'll be gone. I might still be here. But people actually begin going into that. It came to pass. And to me, it's kind of sad because to me, a radio is a Philco cathedral or something like that. To a lot of people that never grew up with that, but they did grow up with that pocket radio, they want to buy it back from eBay or somewhere else.
Yeah, but there you go back to one of my famous Rinker rules. What's the value of anything worth when everybody who remembers it dies?
Yeah. Although I wasn't around when they had Philco cathedrals, and to me, I find them far more attractive as a radio than something I could have bought when I was 10.
But if you go out and buy a Philco cathedral today, even one that's well repaired, the price is steady, not going up.
They're finally starting to even off. The problem is, of course, with eBay is not good for price. eBay is good for finding something you want, because whatever it is that you want, I'm sure there's an antique mall somewhere in the United States where it's selling for 50 cents, but if you try to buy it on eBay, it's going to be $500 for the same dang thing.
Well, you know what? eBay is a form of instant gratification.
Yes.
And guys like you, guys like me, we love to hunt. Part of the adventure was to hunt it, find it in a condition you like it at a price you're willing to pay.
Mm-hmm.
Those were my three criterias. You know, something I want, the condition is what I expect of it, and the price I'm willing to pay. I find a lot of things that were in the condition I wanted to find it in, but not at a price I was willing to pay for it. That was all part of the fun of just hunting, okay?
Mm-hmm.
Today, it's instant gratification. When I was a kid growing up at my grandmother's place, my uncle, Bill, was still, my parents lived, and I, my family lived with my grandparents for 2 years in Bethlehem, PA. My uncle Bill was in high school at the time, and he had a BB gun, okay?
Yeah.
A Daisy BB gun. And he passed it down to his kids, and his kids still have it, and I wanted that BB gun in the worst darn way. And so finally I said, okay, I'm just going to go buy one. Now, I could have hunted and hunted and hunted. I just went up on the net, found the guy that dealt with and restored BB guns, said, how much you want for one like this? And he smiled. He said, this is what I want. He said, fine, I'll pay it. It beat all the money I would have spent traveling around on gasoline, hotel rooms,
right,
time, and everything else to buy it. It was just cheaper to buy it up, to pay probably 2 to 3 times what I thought it was worth to get it right away, instant gratification, but also not have to put out the money. Then, because when people used to say to me, oh, hey, Harry, I went to a flea market and I found this wonderful cathedral radio in working condition for $200. Isn't that great? I said, wait a minute. Did you pay $200 for it? He said, yeah. I said, what did it cost? He said, what do you mean, what did it cost me? I paid $200 for it. I said, no. What did it cost you in time? What was your time per hour worth to go there, find it and pick it up? What did it cost for the transportation? What did it cost for food? What did it cost if it stayed overnight? The total cost of that radio is all those combined.
Right. Which is why there's certain radios I wouldn't bother to pay, that I'd love to have, but I'm not going to pay what it's worth, even if I had the money. If I hit one of these mega jackpot things.
That's
But then so what?
You know, that was one of the smart things I learned when I was buying, not because I was buying with the idea of reselling, but I've got a lot of things I can resell for far more than I paid for them. And that was because I never looked at what's the price a day. I looked and said, what is the chance of this thing being worth something in 20 or 30 years? And will the market have gone down and will I have wasted my money? Because, you know, how do you know when you pay too much? The answer is when you pay too much is when you go to sell it, you can't get your money out of it.
Right. But see, I never bought a radio in my life with the idea of, ooh, what can I sell this for in 20 years? I bought it because I like that radio. Now, if I like it enough and I can afford it, yes. If somebody says, okay, this radio is $250, do you like it that much? No. That radio is $25. I like it. Yeah, that's part of it.
That was one of the things when I bought things. I go out and I looked and say something I wanted, right?
Yeah.
And I said, if it's worth it, if it's priced this at this much, and I think it's a fair price, I'll pay it.
Right.
If it's overpriced, I'll offer him what I think is a fair price, and if he takes it, I'll pay it. If it's priced way above what I'm willing to pay, I won't even bother to talk to him. Because he thinks it's worth one thing, and I think it's worth a far different amount. Because something was only ever worth to me what I was willing to pay for.
Right. Before you go, though, I want to ask you something here. They mentioned in some of these articles, they say a 1980s original Transformers toy, new in the box, yada, yada, we know, sold for $20,000 last year. Again, somebody has more money than brains, but that's if you love it, that's fine. It's your money.
Because,
I don't care.
Because all of a sudden, this isn't a collectible. This is an investment thing.
Well, that's the thing that gets me.
This is what companies like, Harry's Auctions and stuff, they convince people with money to buy movie posters, to buy this stuff, not because it's worth collecting, but because it's a potential speculative investment.
Yeah.
Okay. Now, the old money is you buy stocks, the concept is if you can't afford to lose your money, don't buy the stocks, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's the same thing for stuff like that. If you can't afford to lose it, don't buy it.
Well, just to throw something in, I know of a store, and I'm not going to say where, but I've over the past 20 years, I've seen the same movie poster in the same frame, and they move it around the store, and they wanted $45 for it 20 years ago, and they still want $45, and nobody's bought it yet.
Yes, there is a message there.
Yeah, there is. I mean, if it had been a lot less and it was a movie, we're not talking Casablanca. It was some obscure movie. But something about this, in the stories that I've been reading, maybe the next generation of collectibles or collectors are not doing it for the love of the things, as you and I did. They're just doing it for speculation. Oh, this is my retirement.
But then they're not collectors. They're investors.
Yeah, that's the thing that's sad to me. I never bought a radio thinking, like I said, oh, I'm making an investment. I bought it because I like this and I can afford this. And it's not outrageously expensive. You know, an expensive radio is $75.
You can take markets like Tiffany Lamps and others where, you know, they're considered the high-end epitome stuff and people pay now hundreds of thousands of dollars for them. Fine. In 100 years, are they going to pay $100,000 for them? I doubt it.
No. No.
But then again, I don't going to be here to see if I'm right or wrong anyway, so what do I care?
But quick question to play off of that. You used to do the vault where you would get the toys every Christmas and put them away and see what they had appreciated to or what. And whatever happened to all that stuff, and did it actually...
They sold it at auction. When I closed the school down, I sold it all off.
Uh-huh.
And I did... And you know, I did okay. I some of the stuff I bought, man, they got 10 to 20 times what I paid for it. Others say that they didn't do as well. But it's all a game. It's all, you know, when somebody goes to sell something or they're selling their house, I go in and I say, well, okay, if you sell this at auction, this is what I think you'll get. And they said, oh, man, if I can get that, I'll be really happy. So, okay, so the auction comes, okay. And they get more than I told them they would get.
Right.
So I say to them, oh, look at this. They said, yeah, but wait a minute. They sold this, and it didn't bring what I thought it should bring. And the auctioneer sold that, and that didn't bring what he thought it would bring. The auction didn't. Here's a bunch of stuff the auctioneer gave back, and he didn't even sell it.
Mm-hmm.
I said, Well, yeah. I said, well, what are you complaining about? You got more than we thought. Well, he said, yeah, but this one piece was my favorite. It didn't even get enough bids to be sold.
Well, then keep it.
And I said, well, aren't you lucky to get it back?
But I said,
how do you think they got more than we estimated? I said, what about all that stuff they thought you thought was crap and they got good money for it?
Yeah, enjoy that.
Yeah, those are the ones you should be happy about.
You'd think.
You know, it was never how you got to the end result. It was the end result that was important.
I suppose, yeah. Well, it's been fun, Harry. I appreciate you doing the show.
It's always fun talking to you. It's always fun because I think we talk about some things, even though I've been, you know, I went cold turkey in the market in December of 2021. It's been 5 years.
Mm.
I follow the market. I do still get one trade publication. I look at it. I get the Manatee Digest because I like the high end of the market. And I look at it, and it reminds me of my glory days. I used to go out and do appraisal clinics. My wife has been after me to do one for her DAR group down here, and I refuse. I don't answer any letters anymore. There's only one person I still do this silliness for, and it's you, buddy.
Well, thank you very much. Appreciate it.
I appreciate all the support I had from all the radio DJs and television people that supported me through all those years. I had a great run, probably. One of the fun careers that anybody could have was the career I had in the antiques and collectibles game. Now I get enormous pleasure dealing with dead people.
Doing the genealogy.
Yeah, well, actually, it's you know, you know how you can't help yourself? Well, I now do a quarterly column, not a weekly column. I'll never do one of those again. But I do a quarterly column now called Skeletons in the Closet, and it's reflections by an SAR register, you know, talking about all the things you uncover when you do genealogy, that some of which most people would rather not know about. And I also train and do Zooms to train people to do genealogy and work for the SAR and the DAR. And it's great fun for me, and I have a grand time at it, but I'll do it under the same principles I did my work in the antiques and collectibles field. When it was fun, I kept it up. But I got to a point in 2011 where I was spending more time telling people what they had wasn't worth what they thought it was than what it was. And, you know, that's no fun. It's not that I'm unwilling to tell people what I think. Obviously, I do that all the time. But it's no fun to be the bad guy all the time. And that's what it was happening over and over again. People who got ill, who had collections, they're ill, they have to sell out, they need money, and they should have sold 35 years earlier when the stuff was collected.
True.
And so it's sad. I mean, I look at stuff today in antique malls that I didn't buy in the 1970s because it was too expensive. It's now still has 1970s prices on it, and I won't buy it.
You don't need it.
I don't. Well, it has no appeal to me anymore. So other than that, life is good, but it is great now. You know, you take good care of yourself. Again, I say hi to all my friends at WRTA. I really have very, very fond memories of being on that network for a good part of my life, and hopefully we'll do this again.
Yeah, maybe this summer. We'll see. Harry, be well.
Hey, you too.